invitée te ordine a ti podcast.
The performative aspects of language. Sue Sanders angol nyelvű előadása a Közép-Európai Egyetemen 2023. március 5-én a nyelv performatív aspektusairól.
What I would love to do is to have a dialogue. So, is that all right there? Great, good. So, do feel free to wave, interrupt me, yell, whatever, so we can have a chat. But I would also like questions afterwards. So let's make it a bit of a dialogue rather than a monologue, if it's at all possible. So I should explain Professor Emeritus, just because I feel that it's a bit cheeky. Those of you who know Harvey Milk, is he familiar to you? Yes, good. His nephew, Stuart Milk, and I have done lots of work together. He comes over to Britain, and he's been to Sweden, and he's been to Serbia, and he's even been here. And he asked me one year why I didn't have one of those honours that the Queen doles out. Well, they're called something empire. And I said, I will never have anything with the word empire in it. It's not acceptable to me. No way. So he said, And then he came back with this plaque of making me a professor emeritus. So it's not academic because I never went to university and I'm not an academic. But having the professor emeritus is like a little dream. So it's rather nice. So that's how I get it. So that's wonderful. So what I'm going to talk about this afternoon is language. And I'm assured that what I'm saying makes sense in not just in English, but in other languages as well. So fingers crossed it does. So language has power. How we frame things has a powerful unconscious effect on how we see the world. What we say and what we don't say has power. For instance, in English, the words man and men, used exclusively to describe people, renders women invisible. History, his story, was indeed the story of men until feminists began to unearth all the hidden women. And even then, the women cited were predominantly white, able-bodied, and heterosexual. So, after nearly 2,000 years, we are very, very slowly just beginning to see all women represented in historical references and media in the white Western world. Too often, we write and talk as if our personal internal map is the actual territory in which we all exist. So, for instance, we use language that excludes others. When somebody uses the word family, I might assume they are describing the same type of family as I had. Inclusive language requires thought and knowledge. We often don't know what we don't know. And maybe because we don't want to offend, we are frightened of using the wrong words in case we do. What we say, when we say it, where we say it, why we say it, how we say it, and who says it is crucial, for context is all. At the moment, there appears to be a powerful attack on the rights of LGBT plus people in several countries, which could easily intimidate educationalists. Indeed, it is designed to do just that. As a veteran of Section 28, a law in the UK which made the promotion of homosexuality illegal and the promotion of a pretended family relationship, a phrase deliberately designed to stigmatize all relationships by LGBT people, I am very familiar with such tactics. It was enacted in 1988 and repealed in 2003. It did a great deal of damage, setting up an atmosphere which encouraged homophobic bullying in schools and hate crime on the streets. LGBT people were either made invisible by the media or were vilified. It is 20 years since this was repealed, and we have made progress as LGBT people. But since the Brexit, the current government have used our community, and particularly our trans siblings, as a distraction and scapegoated them, in the hope we won't notice their gross inadequacy and corruption. Many people will know a trans person, though the recent census puts the population in the UK of 0.5%. For the very first time, our census actually asked us to define our sexual orientation and our gender identity. So if you want to know that information, it's quite useful to see that, and it was the first time they'd ever done it. Many accept a trans man as a man and a trans woman as a woman and call them by their correct pronouns. You certainly would not know that listening to our politicians, who are stirring up a very antagonistic culture at the moment. How they are doing this can be easily demonstrated by the model that Gordon Allport came up with in 1954. Now, if you're familiar with this, I do apologise, but if you haven't come across it, I think you'll find it very useful. Gordon Allport was an American psychologist who, in exploring how fascism and groups like the Ku Klux Klan gained traction, came up with this model. So if you look at the first level, the bottom of the triangle, he came up, sociologists, psychologists, they have to invent words. I should speak, I do it as well. But he came up with this concept of antilocution. So it's bad speech, basically, jokes, bantering. It's a majority group who freely make jokes about a minority group. Speech is in terms of negative stereotypes and negative images, which is also obviously called hate speech. It is commonly seen as harmless by the majority. Oh, it's just banter. Oh, I was only joking. We've all heard those things. Oh, it doesn't matter. I only just said this, whatever. But antilocution may not be harmful in itself, but what it does, it sets the stage for some more severe forms of prejudice. So if you don't deal with that bantering and hate speech, we move up to the next layer, level two. But the examples are about jokes about the Irish, the French, the blacks and the gays. And it uses labels in such a way that invites a bystander to make a choice to be the victim of a bully or, of course, to be the bully. And too many people make the choices to be the bully. So as I say, if that isn't dealt with, we move up to avoidance. Sending people to Coventry is an idiom we use in England. We just don't do them. Now, as a teacher, how many teachers in the room or people who work in education? Okay, only a few of you. But this might make sense to you. Somebody isn't very popular and has been left an ostracized. So I'm a powerful person in a group. I walk up to this person who has been ostracized, not taking notice, and I come and stand by you and I look at you and you think, oh, goodness, maybe this, they're actually going to sit next to me. And then I walk on by. It's very subtle and not everybody notices it. You notice it, but not everybody does. And very often, that person who is put in that position then retaliates and they become the person who is challenged for bullying. But what they're doing is they're responding to very subtle, hidden bullying called avoidance. Is this making sense? Go, oh, good. So they're ostracized, these people. So if that isn't dealt with, we then move up to the next layer, which is discrimination. So the minority group is discriminated against by denying them opportunities and services and putting prejudice into action. So the behaviours have the specific goal of harming the target group by preventing them from achieving their goals, getting education or jobs or housing, etc. And there's institutional discrimination and there's personal discrimination. But basically what it is the majority group is actively trying to harm the target group. If that isn't dealt with, we then move up to the next layer, which is physical attack. But you'll notice that under physical attack, there is this word graffiti. Is that, do we know what, I'm not using words that you don't, you know what I mean, scribbles on walls, which are horrendous, yeah? So if they're not dealt with, the thing about graffiti is, if it's left up, the person who that is about has no idea who put it up there, and if it's not taken down, assumes that everybody agrees with it. So it's very powerful and very painful. And there are some places which will be very quick to take down graffiti. But in schools, I often notice there's graffiti in the toilets, under desk lids, which nobody does anything about. So, but also under in this layer, he's talking about physical attack. The majority group vandalize the target group's possessions. They burn property, carry out violent attacks on individuals or groups. Physical harm is done to members of the target group. Examples are muggings, lynchings, pogroms against Jews in Europe, etc. We're all familiar with the horrendousment of that. If that isn't dealt with, we then move up to the final layer, extermination. And we are seeing that in all sorts of different ways across Europe, and have seen it, obviously, where the majority group or the group in power seek to exterminate the target group. The attempt to liquidate an entire group of people, the Indian Wars to remove Native Americans, the final solution, the Jewish problem, ethnic cleansing in Bosnia, etc. When that's going down, it is not surprising that so many people then take their own lives and commit suicide. And I think within the LGBT community, do come in. Hi. Within the LGBT community, we are very aware of the high potential of our youngsters committing suicide. And if we go back down here, if we're thinking about level 3 unfair discrimination, a high level of our young LGBT people don't have housing. So when we look at the percentage of young people who are homeless in the UK, an out of proportion of those are young LGBT people, because they're being discriminated by their family or by the institutions. And then the institutions aren't very good at actually finding them housing. So I think you might agree that this is a very useful model to see how the whole process is built on language. And if we are not careful with our language, and if we don't actually think about how we are using language, it can escalate up. So I've just written a book. Well, I haven't written a book. I've written a foreword. Tony got the book together. I have information here. So it's a glossary which is looking at inclusive language and language about all the discriminated books. So you might find it useful. I've got information about it there, and you can buy it on the LGBT History Month bookshop. It's edited by Dr. Tony Malone. And in it, we mention the social model of disability. Now, if you're not familiar with this, I hope you'll find this useful. It's the work of Mike Oliver, which tells us that it's a society that has disabled people, not their disabilities. So it's changing round the whole concept of thinking about, you know, how is a disabled person disabled, not disabled by their handicap or by their illness, but by society. This places the responsibility on society to be inclusive. So the social model, which is what he came up with, he recognized that people were disabled by the attitudes and behaviors of our society that ignores the needs of disabled people and builds structures that puts physical and attitudinal barriers to their accessibility. I have argued that this ignoring and hindering is true for other social groups that face prejudice. Black people and people seeking asylum, women, LGBT plus people, we all face such institutional oppression. But we will frequently blame ourselves instead of the institutions and the social. Being able to label our oppression is vital. And it's no surprise that such words as racism, sexism, ableism, Islamophobia, homophobia are relatively recent words. Homophobia was coined, interestingly enough, by George Weinberg, who was a heterosexual in the 60s. But what he was doing was trying unsuccessfully to educate his fellow psychologists, who he saw not only hated homosexuals, but were afraid of them. Having a word that accurately describes the prejudice we are facing is the first step to dismantle it. And when I look at very early films that we had in Britain of LGBT people in the 60s and early 70s, trying to get people to understand what they were dealing with, not having that shorthand homophobia, or for women having that word sexism, or for black people racism or Islamophobia, it's really crucial to have a word which describes your oppression. Then there is the problem of victim-blaming language. Habitually, the press and the media describe hate crimes in such a way. For example, the woman was attacked because she was a lesbian. Well, that tells us that the victim was a passive recipient of the violence that was caused by her being perceived as a lesbian. If the report said a perpetrator, motivated by their homophobia, attacked a woman who he perceived to be a lesbian, we would know that this was a hate crime, motivated by hate, and the action of a person who made assumptions that resulted in him acting out his hate. The woman may or may not be a lesbian and may or may not have fought back, but the description of the event would be accurate if incomplete. Defining the crime by the motive of the criminal makes it clear where the responsibility for the hate crime lies. The accurate description does sound clumsy. Now, is this true in the languages that you speak as well? Can I get feedback? Yes? That the press blame the victim. It's really interesting, isn't it? We don't put the spotlight on the perpetrator. This is because we have become used to language that blames the victim and not the perpetrator, that describes the victim as a passive recipient of a crime and leaves out the actual criminal or predator. Is it any wonder, therefore, that our legal systems ignores the rights of such victims? If our language blames the victim, then it is hard to reframe our attitudes and beliefs. And then, even with laws in place, victims often blame themselves when they are victims of discrimination or attack, and they don't report it to the authorities. So you will frequently find that women will take the blame for a rape, won't report it. You'll frequently find that lesbian and gay, bisexual, trans people will say, well, I was holding hands, I was wearing weird clothing, I attracted attention. So it's self-blaming, which is just not acceptable. When the victims do report an incident or crime to the authorities, they often experience a response that either ignores the report or delays taking appropriate action or obfuscates the issues. Sometimes the authorities actually sabotage the correct proceedings. The passive, victim-blaming language therefore reflects the reality that society does indeed blame the victim. And you'll be familiar, I suspect, with the recent murder of young Brianna Gay, 17-year-old young trans woman. A crime that unfortunately was totally predictable due to the anti-trans atmosphere in our country. And the police, against all the guidelines in place in dealing with serious crimes, immediately stated it was not a hate crime. Now, that was against every piece of guidance that we have been putting in place with the police to say any crime like this should immediately be seen as potentially a hate crime. And then if when you've looked at it, it then becomes that it wasn't that, then you can take it down. Sir.
I was actually following the BBC during this time. Uh-huh. And I remember the first time they talked about this murder.
Yes.
And I believe the coverage haven't even covered her being transgender until a few days after it was first announced.
There was a variety of different reports. A very unpleasant paper called the Daily Mail, which we call the Daily Fail, not only said she was trans, but misgendered her. The Telegraph did something similar. The Telegraph is a vicious piece of horrendousment on the right wing. And the BBC has had a history of being very transphobic. So we are dealing with the BBC, The Guardian, not very helpful either, The Telegraph, The Daily Mail, which we'd expect from. But from the papers that we would expect some sort of support around trans issues, we have not had it, which is highly problematic. I am working with the school where the young woman went. And I have confidential information, which at this point I can't share. But it will, I think, eventually come out what the actual situation is, if what I've been told is true. But it's been abundantly clear that the way that was reported made us all feel very angry and invisibilized us yet again. And for trans people who were dealing regularly with bullying and hate crime and discrimination, to have it immediately said that it wasn't a hate crime was just outrageous. And you will have noticed that across the country there have been an innumerable vigils for Brianna Gay. So it's been a very powerful pulling together of the community to challenge the inappropriate language and prejudice against trans people.
Thank you.
So, in educational institutions, we further obfuscate, as we call hate crime, bullying. And it's something I get very upset about when they say, oh, they're being bullied. No, it just lessens it. We should be using the word hate crime. If it was the same thing happened on the streets, that's what it would be. The effect of such victim-blaming language encourages internalized homophobia, sexism, disabilism, transphobia, and obviously racism. Society's rules are enacted through language. Our laws use this same language. So if we want to change the reality of hate crimes and unlawful discrimination going unacknowledged and unpunished, we must change the language. And those of us who are teachers, or those of us who are parents, or those of us who've got brothers and sisters, we obviously have a massive responsibility. Children are not born racist or homophobic or ableist or misogynistic. They are taught it. And it's our job to educate out that prejudice. Language undermines the appreciation of our diverse culture by the way we can imply judgment by the use of the term normal. It's a simple word that carries a great deal of weight. It invites us to approve of something, to see it as healthy, unthreatening, and correct. The word abnormal is used to describe the unhealthy when applied to psychology. It has been used to describe people with a disability, people who describe themselves as LGBT plus, and criminals. The term subnormal has been used to describe people of color and women when trying to justify enslaving them or depriving them of their rights reserved for white, cis, heterosexual, able-bodied, middle or upper class Christian men. To judge the normality of a person is a very powerful tool in the hands of the elite. When it is used to exclude those not in the group, in the elite group, the underclass results. Now, during the whole time I fought Section 28, the word normal was being bandied about. Why don't we have people, you know, we must support normal families. We must support normal people. So over the years, I have promoted the term of the word usual in our dictionary, but just saying, instead of using normal, use usual. And usualize to replace normal and normalize in order to suggest words that do not imply a hierarchy. I see usual and usualizing as more neutral terms without the history of promoting exclusion and oppression. So, we at Schools Out supply resources and lesson plans for teachers to usualize LGBT issues throughout the curriculum and for all ages to enable students to be introduced into the reality of LGBT plus people as an everyday occurrence. Whether it is in English or maths, it is an easy task to drop in examples that indicate the existence of LGBT plus people. And we would also encourage teachers to consider using the same idea for other groups that have been deliberately hidden or discriminated against. So, for instance, a maths lesson, which you'll find on the classroom website, has different shapes. And the teacher simply says, these are the shapes that the tents and the pavilions at Brighton Pride. Simple as that. Doesn't make a big deal of it. I'm not a great advancer of the gay lesson or the black lesson or the disabled lesson. I want to usualize this across the whole curriculum. So it's a step along the way to decolonize the curriculum and make visible what has been deliberately made invisible. Institutional oppression exists in many of our educational establishments. So training for all staff to effectively deal with all forms of hate crime, be it verbal or physical, is crucial. It needs to be focused on educating rather than punishment. A zero tolerance program is useless when you are not backing it up with inclusive education that informs students or work people or whoever, wherever you're doing the work, informs the people about difference and celebrates it. So, this requires a comprehensive audit of all the materials that we use. Teachers look at the curriculum. If you're in a workplace, you look at your posters that you put on walls, the language that you use, the policies that are in place. to ensure that we are being inclusive. Where the resources do not exist, then we need to start skilling up our students and staff and look to other institutions like museums and archives, where in the UK, they are beginning to recognise their responsibility for making it clear they have LGBT plus artefacts and information. So in the past, when I went to very famous houses like where Peter Sackville West lived, you would never know that she had a lesbian relationship with Virginia Woolf. Now it is clear. And that work needs to constantly be done to make sure that everybody is there. And now there's a lot of work being done to actually start recognizing that many of those houses and museums have very unhealthy relationships to the slave trade and begin to recognize it and put it up there and explain how they got stuff that was stolen, basically. So we've seen such projects existing in our LGBT History International Festival Out in the Past. So Out in the Past supports museums and archives to put on events which make LGBT plus visible. Our schools and workplaces need effective practices that encourages reports of discrimination and transparent ways of dealing with it. So regular surveys asking students and all staff, whether in a workplace or an institution or school, what, where, and when they see or hear discriminatory language behavior. Regularly ask. Regularly discover where it's going down. Find out to whom they reported it and what the outcome was. Gives us vital information to eliminate it. But don't do it just once, because it'll move. You sort it out from there in the bathroom, it'll move somewhere else. So do it regularly. And if you do it regularly, people begin to believe that you really mean to try and change things. We started LGBT History Month in the UK after 15 years of a law that was intended to silence and invisibilise LGBT plus people, Section 28. Our intention was not only to make us visible, but to claim our past by providing resources that introduce people to the rich heritage that LGBT plus people in all their diversity have left us. To celebrate our present, by providing the spaces, museums, archives, unions, corporates, theatres, educational institutions, etc., the ability to explore and celebrate LGBT plus culture and visibilise us, and to create our future, to continue the much needed work to ensure that all LGBT plus people in their full diversity. And that to me is so crucial. So often when we talk about LGBT, the pictures are of white men. And I find that really problematic. So for all my work has been making it clear that we are talking about the full diversity of the LGBT community, old, the young, the religious, the non-religious, the trans, the non-trans, the plus, everybody, the able-bodied, the disabled. I mean, it's trying to get people to recognize that full, creative, amazing community that we are. So to create our future, continue the much needed work to ensure that all LGBT plus people in their full diversity have the means and support to live healthy, productive lives. And importantly, work towards creating a safe, inclusive society that has dismantled institutional oppression. We are now working with a variety of countries around the world, supporting them to have their own LGBT History Months. And Cuba held their first one last year. And as you know, I was very honoured to open your 11th LGBT History Month last night. It was, as I hope you all felt, an amazing event. I felt amazing energy and excitement in the room. It was really wonderful. And it's a wonderful opportunity to visibilise and celebrate LGBT plus experience and contribution to society. So I hope you feel rededicated to the vital work to support all human rights. Such rededication is vital, for whatever rights we have in our countries now, they are fragile. The Conservatives are on the march, and we can see that by hook or by crook, they are determined to undermine our human rights and attack democracy. So, I urge you to join your unions, work with charities and organisations that work to undercut the right and celebrate and support the discriminated against. And be the beacon of light that dispenses ignorance and prejudice. Thank you.